Alan Chartok. Joining us today is playwright David Epstein, one of my oldest friends, whose work, Brace Yourself, will receive its world premiere at the Berkshire Theatre Group's Fitzpatrick Main Stage beginning August 18th. A graduate of Brandeis and the Yale School of Drama and a former artist in residence at Colgate University, Epstein has seen his plays produced across the U.S. and Europe. He's also written the book and collaborated on the lyrics for off-Broadway musicals Wanted and The Bonus Army and written for the screen. Brace Yourself takes place at a location dear to me, Fire Island, where wedding attendees await the arrival of a hurricane. But perhaps the real storm is already there. David Epstein, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's great to be here, Alan. Thanks.
Well, you know, it's very wonderful to see somebody who has been so successful in life, who you knew, and your mother used to claim that the two Chartok twins were on one side of the fish scale, and you were on the other one. And to watch how successful you have become in this life, and it must be really heady stuff to present stuff at the wonderful Berkshire Theatre Group. Are you having fun in your life?
I am indeed, and particularly right here, I'm having a great time. This is a lovely place to work, and Kate McGuire has set up, there's an atmosphere in this theater, in the whole area, that is terrific. It's wonderful.
David, a lot of people know you as a playwright, but fewer people know you from your Fire Island days. You've written about Fire Island here. Once you're a Fire Islander, it really sort of stays in your blood, doesn't it?
Oh, well, it's they're formative years, as you know, Alan. And I lifeguarded for 10 years, and I painted houses for a couple of years. I bartended for a year, summer or two. And those experiences were formative indeed. And this play comes somewhat out of that. You know?
Well, why don't you tell everybody who's listening, because not everybody's a Fire Islander. Right. What Fire Island is like?
Well, it's unique in that it's a barrier island off of Long Island. It's very narrow. You can walk from the ocean to the bay in 7 or 8 minutes.
And if you're walking slow.
If you're walking slow, right? And that's the extent of the physical place. And everyone walks around in bare feet for the most. At least they did when we lived there. You know, we haven't lived there in 30 years.
No, we haven't.
And I don't know how much it's changed, but I assume it has changed. But there was a sense of community that was intense and at times very funny and at times nasty, but it was always entertaining.
Your mother and my mother did something together. They founded the Fire Island Youth Group,
right,
where it was the camp, where everybody went to camp.
Except I never went, which drove my mother nuts, I think. But I just had no desire to do that. My friends were the guys who didn't go to camp. So I didn't go to camp. I had jobs as a kid. I was the umbrella boy for a few years on the beach. I was the Western Union guy delivering Western Union telegrams on a bike. I was the only kid in town allowed to ride a bike.
That's right. I knew all of your predecessors.
That's right.
And it was a very sought-after job.
It was a good one because I could ride around. Everybody else was walking. So that was wonderful. But you know, my mother and your mother, who were not unlike in many ways, wonderful, strong-minded women, founded the youth group. And my mother tried to get me to go, just as she tried to get me to go to camp. I don't know if your parents ever tried to get you to go to camp. She wanted me to try something different. And I never would. They used to have people come up to our apartment and with movies of camp experience. And, you know, then my parents would look at me, well, did you like it? I said, I'm not going to camp. And I never went to camp, and I never regretted it.
No. You're a little bit of a barrier buster yourself. As I remember it, maybe this is just lore, but as I remember it, there were two groups of people. There were the people who worked in the youth group who were both Jewish and Gentile, and then there were the lifeguards. There were very few Jewish kids who were ever allowed onto the lifeguards under the legendary automaton Buck Wright.
Well, this is true. I wasn't the first, but my group of guys were among the first, and I think we educated people. You know, when we got there, it was...
Was it hard to get on? I mean, there was a sort of this thing, which the Jewish kids weren't going to be lifeguards.
Well, you know, you had to pass a test. And this guy, Buck Wright, was a tough cookie. And, you know, you had to get out in the ocean and do stuff and prove it. And so it wasn't easy. They weren't giving the jobs away. But, you know, once we started showing that we were, you know, good in the ocean, which is what they cared about.
That you could swim.
Yeah, that you could deal with, you know, the ocean, yeah, which was no simple matter. But, you know, they realized that they had to let us in. You know, I mean, they had no way of, you know, and
the demographic of the island culture was changing.
Absolutely.
When our families got there, we were among the first.
That's right.
And then afterwards, it really got
right.
to be.
And I think, you know, some of my lasting friendships, as mine with you, was with guys I lifeguarded with who whose families, you know, when we got there, had never dealt with Jews. So our friendships as kids informed the parents. And that was, I think, a pretty remarkable, and yet we took it as... you know, as the way life was. And we changed, I think we changed the identity of the place because of that.
There was lots of practicing. I used to watch the lifeguards
line
practicing.
Practice.
A whistle would go, and you get on a line.
Oh,
and
it was
you
tough.
Get a,
yeah.
Tell me about that.
It's called line practice. And every morning we'd walk, I can remember this vividly, and I'd walk down the beach. My house actually was on the same street as the lifeguard shack where we all gathered.
And I'd cottage walk.
And I'd walk down the street and up the stairs to get the first glimpse of the ocean in the morning, right? And that would tell me what kind of day I was going to have, you know. And if you looked up and there were big, big waves, you kind of gulp and went, okay, this is going to be a tough day. And frequently, they decide, the powers, the guys who ran it, decided that these tough days were the days that were going to give us line practice. And those two words could shiver a man's timbers, you know, because you'd look out there, these enormous waves, and we'd have to pretend that we were going to go out and rescue one of us. So one of us would, get sent out beyond the waves, and then the rest of us would have to go get them.
The guy in the front of the line had a buoy, right?
Yeah, can buoy. The method was a what they call a can buoy, which was a floatable, maybe 3 or 4 feet long and shaped as a bullet. And it would have a line that you would carry it with on one hand, and another hand you'd put it over your shoulder. So it would trail behind you when you got in the water, but first you had to get through the waves. And so you're carrying this thing, these huge waves are coming down over you, and you had to power through the waves and then start swimming, and you let go of the line so that Kambui would trail behind you. Then the second guy had the line, and he had a line that was attached to a spool back on the beach. And he'd put this line over his shoulder, and he'd swim after the guy with the can buoy. And you'd get to the victim, and the guy with the can buoy would get there first, and the victim would grab the can buoy, you know, in a good world, and keep himself afloat. Then the guy with the line would arrive, and they'd turn the victim around so he's now no longer facing the shore, which is always tough because people do not like to not face the shore when they're drowning. Right? And you had to convince them to turn and face the sea. And then the fellow with the line would put his arm over and a cross chest carry, and he'd take the line and he'd wrap the line around his hand. And he'd raise his hand, and the fellows on the beach would see the hand raised, which was the signal to start pulling. And then suddenly there'd be, and this you could pull your arm out of it. They could pull your arm out of the socket if you weren't careful, because there'd be this sudden jolt of three guys on the beach yanking you and the victim back to shore. So what you had to do was put your arm down by your side and strain down so that you weren't just letting your shoulder get pulled out of the socket.
Now, there are a couple of things that need to be said here. These were events, so that when that whistle blew and the line, and you, this is very dramatic.
Right.
When
the whole beach line would out, jump up.
Everybody would jump up and come around to see see this happening.
Very
so you were
dramatic.
Performing. Yeah. I often wonder whether some of that performance excited you to the point where you became a playwright.
Oh, I don't know, but it was a performance, there's no doubt about it. And some of them, of course, were less dramatic than others. And there were some that were funny and some that were awful. And, you know, the funnier ones were ones where you'd get out there and people would look at you like you were nuts because they didn't know that they were in trouble. And say, what are you doing here? They'd look at us and say, you're in trouble, you're drifting. And then they look up and see how far out they were and they realize, or they'd get terribly embarrassed.
Yeah.
And they'd come in and as soon as they were safe, they'd start yelling, I didn't need your help. This is ridiculous. You didn't have to come and save me so that everyone on the show would know that, you know, they were totally in control, which they weren't.
But sometimes you really had to do CPR, right?
Yeah. Not often because, and I think this is one of the good things. I mean, we were instructed and learned to frequently get people before they were in big trouble.
Yeah.
That we didn't wait that long. And sometimes, of course, you couldn't help it.
Yeah.
But we often, you know, got them right at that crucial moment when they were about to, you know, get in deep trouble.
Now, subsequently, people have died on Fire Island in the ocean. But when you were there,
we never lost anyone.
You never lost anyone.
Never lost anyone. That was a record. You know, we never lost anyone. And it was a very controlled beach. I mean, you could only swim between certain lines.
Well, we have to talk about that. Yeah. Tell us about the red flag and the green flag.
Right. Well, we put up flags in the morning to determine how rough the water was. So if it was a red flag day, you were on alert, and some days we didn't even let people in past their knees because there were enormous waves. You know.
What about sharks?
There were a couple of shark scares, but never anything of any, you know, importance.
Okay,
I remember.
So we touched on your busting the anti-Semitic line earlier. Let's talk a little bit about your dad, because I know you gave one of the most eloquent speeches at your father's funeral, but people should know a little bit about him.
My dad was a great father and a terrific man. He was the national director of the Anti-Defamation League for 35 years.
He was the Anti-Defamation League.
Yeah, he really was. And I think I said then, made the world a better place. How many people can say that they made the world a better place? He did. And he was a wonderful father. So I found out subsequently over the years, and still keep being surprised, that I was really lucky. I thought everybody had great fathers. You know, I knew there were differences, but as it turns out, a lot of guys didn't, and I was really fortunate.
Well, we all loved him. He was a gentle, but when he needed to be, he had steel in him. But he didn't use it, you know, in a sort of officious.
No, nothing like that. And you know, he had this rather appearance of calm, and he was a calm, temperate man. But there was a backbone of steel there that only showed when it was needed.
You should tell people a little bit about the Anti-Defamation League. What was it?
Well, it was an organization that was founded to combat anti-Semitism, and of which there was, you know, quite a bit in the early days of this country. And it was founded in, I think, 1910 or 11. And it has subsequently morphed into more of a, an Israel-promoting organization. Its still main charter is to fight anti-Semitism, but it's a very strongly backs Israel.
And he wrote several books, which were, if you lived in a Jewish middle-class home, probably a book by Ben Epstein would be there.
Good chances, yeah. And he collaborated on a number of books with a man named Arnold Foster, who also worked with him. And one of the great things about Dad was that he didn't really consider himself a writer. You know, they outlined the books and drafted chapters, and they had guys working with them. So he was humble in the sense that he didn't consider himself a real writer, but he was very proud to have written these books.
Now, you went to the New Lincoln School. Tell us a little bit about that. It doesn't exist anymore.
It was a great place. It was the cutting edge of what they called progressive education in those days. And you went there, too.
For a little while.
And it was a place where I think the discovery of how to think was at the top of the list and of educating kids. And I think that's what was most significant about the place, is that we learned how to think, not just how to do things, but how to approach interesting subjects. And it's where I discovered that I wanted to be a writer. And because of a couple of the teachers I had and because of the things that we read. I mean, we were reading Henry James and Walt Whitman and terrific stuff when we were in high school and being taught by people who had been college professors and now teaching in this special place because it was an interesting place to teach. And we had, I think, terrific education.
And it was outside the box, I'll tell you that much. I mean, you know, it was not the traditional thing. Right. I guess some of the great Dewey-like people were responsible for founding it, and it was. I remember one time I was put in charge of an assembly, and there was a congressional race, and one of the guys in the race was Adam Clayton Powell, but he wasn't there. He was avoiding a libel judgment, I think in Bimini, as I remember it. But the other two guys were there, a guy who was a socialist and a Republican. And the Republican was heavy. He looked like William Howard Taft, and he had a big thing across his chest. And the other guy was the socialist, and he wore a sort of lefty hat and came on. And after the Republican had given this big speech, the lefty socialist, who was the third party candidate, said, "You know, this guy reminds me a little bit of an antelope, a point here, a point there, and a lot of bull in between." Well, I remember that for the rest of my life, you know, and I've used it 1,000 times myself. It's just fabulous. But where else were you going to get that kind of thing? It was magnificent. So then you went on to Brandeis.
Right. Brandeis at that time was a very exciting place. It was one of the very few co-ed colleges of its, you know, in the higher end of, higher range of academia. And it was also politically very active and aggressively political in many ways. But with terrific professors, and it was a challenging place. I loved it.
The town wasn't very Jewish, but the university certainly was.
Waltham was not, but the college, you know, a couple of my roommates were not Jewish. It wasn't a strictly Jewish place, which, you know, to its benefit, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But wonderful teachers.
What'd you major in?
I majored in English and theater, and I ran into a wonderful guy named John Matthews, who's a playwriting professor. And that's where I took my first playwriting course, and I got hooked. This guy was just sensational. I actually wasn't supposed to be in the class. It was only open to juniors and seniors, and I went in and sort of pleaded, and he said, okay. And the class met once a week, 7 to 10 at night. It's a seminar, which I never had. And I was a sophomore, I guess. And we would sit in this room, about six or eight people, and it was the most exciting room in the school for me. And we'd frequently not end until midnight. You know, we'd start at 7, supposed to be over at 10. Sometimes we'd get out of there at 11 or 12. And it was taught in an intriguing way. I mean, he'd just make assignments, and people would read their own material, and then he'd go around the room to get criticism. You had to criticize your fellow students, and then he
never an easy thing to do. As a professor, I can tell you, there's a sort of code. We don't criticize each other, you know, because they say, okay, what do you think of that?
Yeah.
So it takes a different kind of culture to get that done.
Oh, right. And he wanted us to know what it was like to face criticism, because if you're going to be a writer, what the hell else are you going to be faced with? And this was tough, you know. This was tough stuff, having to sit and listen to people tell you what they thought of your work right there, right after you had read it. It was wonderful. He was a great guy.
So was he your best professor?
I think he was certainly the most memorable, but there were some other ones. There was a guy named Ray Ginger. Ray Ginger was a history professor who was great, and he had a list of what he called minor American heroes, and he attacked history through these characters in American history whom most people hadn't heard of.
Sure.
But he picked out these, one of whom became the character in a play that I had done, a musical, which you mentioned, called The Bonus Army. And his name was Pelham Glassford, and he was the chief of police in Washington, D.C. in the early 30s when the Bonus Army came to Washington to get their money for having fought in World War I, and they had been denied the money,
mm-hmm.
or pushed back and back and back, and suddenly this group of men and some bringing wives and children marched across the country to come to Washington to get their money. And Congress voted them down and didn't give them their money. But Ginger had found this guy, Pelham Glassford, who aided the men and helped them camp out on the Anacostia Flats near the Anacostia River. And he was their champion. And he had to go up against, in the end, the general of the U.S. Army, who was Douglas MacArthur.
And behind Douglas MacArthur was
Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was the captain. And
one of the darker points of Eisenhower's
exactly. Career. And Hoover had, the president had said that he wanted them to help the bonus marchers leave town. They'd been there for a number of months, but no violence. And MacArthur came in with tanks and got, you know, one person, I think just one person was killed, baby was killed, and MacArthur, you know, started to make his reputation from that event. But that character, Pelham Glassford, is in this musical that I did with Al Carmine's at Judson Church in the Village many years after that, but I got that from Ray Ginger's idea.
Interesting. Yeah. We're talking to David Epstein, the playwright, and he is got a new play, Brace Yourself, world premiere, Berkshire Theatre Group's Fitzpatrick Main Stage, beginning August 18th. David, the next thing up, of course, was Yale. Now, Yale has been a profound influence on an awful lot of people in the arts. Tell us a little bit about your experience there.
Well, Yale was, I got there and the School of Drama was dying. In the year I arrived, and it was filled with antediluvian professors who had rules, and you know, a full-length play had to be three acts. You know, a character had to be this. You know, they had these rules, and I was there at first year, and I was ready to leave. It was terrible. It was stultifying. And towards the end of the year, it was announced that Robert Brustein was being appointed the dean. And was going to take over and come the next year. And Bob Brustein, who is a friend of mine now, came up there with his associate dean, who's a man named Gordon Rogoff, who was a terrific critic and a good guy, and to meet with the students who were there. And I met with Gordon Rogoff, and he convinced me to come back. And that was really the beginning of my creative life. Because that next year and the next many years at Yale for me were exhilarating. And they brought energy and excitement to a place that had long been in, you know, it had been dormant. And it was quite a place.
How do they teach you to be a playwright?
Well, you know, you can't teach talent, but you can teach, I think, the most significant thing, which is energy and excitement. And to me, to be able to leave a classroom, I had two writing professors, one of whom became a great friend named Richard Gilman. Dick Gilman was one of the great drama critics in American life. He died a few years ago. Dick Gilman is a brilliant mind. He had written books that are as good today as they were then. And he made me want to, when I left the classroom, he excited me and made me want to go home and work and write. And that's the best thing that you can ever have in a writing teacher, someone who inspires you to want to leave class and go write rather than leave class and go drink. You know? And Arnold Weinstein was the other. Arnold was a playwright, a man of immense talent and verbal dexterity who... And both of these guys had great humor, and they were wonderfully funny, and could turn a moment into a hilarious time in a classroom, which is quite valuable. And they were sharp, and their critical acumen was such that, you know, we just tuned into them. I found that I was on an open channel creatively all of a sudden. Because I was so tuned into these guys.
You got a degree when you got out, right?
Yeah, I got a master's, MFA,
How important is that to be a playwright?
It's not important at all. but what's interesting is my parents, and you'll appreciate this more than most, were desperate that I get a doctorate, you know, because they also offered a doctorate in dramatic. It was in criticism. And I said, I wasn't interested in getting a doctorate. And my mother particularly said, but you can always teach with a doctorate. You can be a professor. And I said, I don't want to teach college. It doesn't interest me. That's not what I want to do. And I went back and forth. And needless to say, I did not get the doctorate. But my mother, you know, was not happy that I didn't. But I got the master's. And then I found out. Now, flash forward almost 40 years, 35 years, and I'm up at Colgate, where I've been asked to be artist in residence. And at some point, someone tells me that that's another story, the Colgate story we didn't get to. Mm-hmm. I'd been asked to come up there by my good friend Jacques Levy, who is a renowned director, and Jacques had directed plays of mine, and he was running the Colgate department, and he got asked me to come up for a semester, which I did, and I had a wonderful time. And then he asked me a year later to come back for another semester as artist in residence, which I did, and then he got sick. And Jacques had to leave school for a while, and I wound up taking over a number of his classes. And this I went on for 2 years, and Jacques got sicker and died, which was a huge blow, not just to those of us who loved him, but to the American theater. But his position suddenly was open, and it was the director of the theater department, and someone one of the people who was on the committee, the search committee, asked me to put my hat in the ring, you know, to be the theater director. And I had a lot of reluctance, my first reluctance was to say, well, you know, I don't. Jacques had a doctorate. I said, I don't have a doctorate. And this person looked at me and she said, well, an MFA is, I forget what the term is for.
It's a terminal degree.
Is a terminal degree for this position. I said,
it's true.
It is? Yeah. And they said, yes. And all I could think of was, oh my gosh, my mother, here it is 30 years later. And I, in fact, had the degree that I needed. And thank God I didn't spend all those years getting a doctorate, you know, which I didn't need and didn't want.
Especially in an ancillary field, which was not what you were doing.
Right. It's not what I was interested in. But I decided not to put my hat in the ring because for a number of reasons. We just didn't want to do it. And I really wanted to be there originally because Jacques was there and he was no longer there. So I left.
Anybody who knows your wife, Kate, knows that she is one of the loveliest, nicest people in the world.
Thank you.
How'd you meet her?
I met her on Fire Island.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, we met on Fire Island, and a friend of ours said to me one day on the beach, he said, he happened to be a married friend of ours.
Look at that.
He said, you want to come down to Seaview. There's this great girl down there who's she's an au pair or a mother's helper or something. You ought to come down and meet her. And I think about it. And at some point I'm walking in that direction. I said, oh, yeah, Michael said I should come down and look for this girl. So I came down and I found her. And that was, 1970, I think.
What was that original conversation like?
And she had this most glorious smile and just sort of a beaming personality and smarts, and she was running around after this little blonde kid. And there was just something about her that was pulled me towards her, that was the beginning.
How long did it take to marry her?
Oh, we lived together for 5 or 6 years.
Where at?
In the village, Village.
And
in fact, the end of that summer, she was supposed to go up to Alfred University, Alfred, New York, and she was going to get a degree up there, and she had a place to stay that friends had given her, and so our plan was to continue our relationship long distance, right? Now, so we got in his car and we drove up there, and it was a really long way away. I had no idea how long a haul it was. And we stayed, I think, 2 nights. And I'm thinking, knowing if I leave her here, it's the end of this relationship, because I can't drive. It was like 7 or 8 hour drive. She's going to get a bus and come back. So I packed her up and she came home with me. And that was the end of Alfred University. And we started living together in the village. She went to work and got finished her undergraduate degree at Hunter. She started at NYU and she had started at Bryn Mawr.
We all went to Hunter.
Right. And she went to NYU and then she got her degree at Hunter and then she went and got her master's in oceanography at Columbia.
Did she do anything with the ocean?
Well, she did a lot of research when she was a student. She'd take these voyages 100 miles out into the Atlantic where they, you know, do core samples, and she was the only person on the boat who didn't get seasick. You know, she'd arrive for breakfast in the morning. There was no one there. And, have I missed something? Where is everybody? They were all in their cabin seasick. Never bothered her. So that's what she did.
And you have three kids?
The three kids, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
David, tell us a little bit about the play.
The play is set in Fire Island. And it's what's interesting, you know, as I started working on this play, let me tell you for a moment how it happened. A friend of mine is an actor, wonderful, another one of my Yale friends, as is Jim Norton, who's directing this play, and Jill Eikenberry, who is in it. But this is Ken Howard, who is an old friend of mine from Yale.
The White Shadow?
The White Shadow. Mm-hmm. And Ken used to come visit us on Fire Island. And
along with your other friend, then Dave Roberts, now Tony Roberts.
Tony's a great friend and a lifelong friend. And anyway, I was talking to Ken. He lives in California. We talk all the time. And he said, I forget how it came up, but he said to me at some point, well, why don't you write a comedy? I said, I'd love to write. I love, you know, everything I write has comic stuff in it. But I don't have anything right on the tip. And he said to me, you got to be kidding. I said, what do you mean? He said, Fire Island. And I said, well, what?
Is he a Fire Islander? No, he came to visit you.
He came to visit. Yeah. And his take on it was comic. And he suddenly...
How so? Why was it comic?
He saw the kind of what the household was like, you know.
You mean your household?
Our household. Yeah. And what the nature of the place was like, which was people just walked in. I mean, that was it was...
Right.
No, you didn't call to make an appointment to come visit somebody.
I was in and out of that.
You just
walk
in and out. Yes, and you know, perfunctory knock on the door, and then you're in.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, you'd hear a voice, Ben, Ethel, you know, my parents, and then someone would be in the house. And a lot of them were very annoying people whom my sister and I couldn't stand, you know? And then a lot of them were wonderful people whom we loved. But it was constant. It was this constant flow of people and kids. And Ken saw that as funny, you know. But what was intriguing to me is, as soon as he said it, I suddenly saw it in a different way from the way I had lived it my whole life, you know. And I said, that's how the play evolved. And I started thinking, well, what is it that I could get into? And I realized that there were a number of things that were intriguing about Fire Island. One was the fact that it was this fragile little island. You know, and it was subject to hurricanes. And so we went through, as I'm sure you did, a couple of these experiences where, either they didn't warn us in time and we were suddenly in the middle of a hurricane, which could have been disastrous, or they had these early warning systems a little later where they were evacuating people, you know, and, you know, often for no reason at all. And so I posited that as one of the events, one of the major events. And the other was the idea of a wedding. You know, this actually never happened in my family, but the idea that a family is having a wedding on Fire Island, which coincides with the arrival of a hurricane. And what do you do in that situation?
As somebody who was married on the back porch on Fire Island myself,
weddings loom large for me.
Yeah. Right.
So there it is, you know, this impending wedding and this, you know, moving northeast hurricane. And add to that an old aunt who's been shipped to the family for the wedding, and what happens to her at this event or before this event, and all of which was secondary to the main character, who was a domineering mother. And that's the character that, that's the character
that
I
wanted to. This
is a
good time
to
tell everybody that your mother would sit on the front porch of the house, and we would come in, as you have described, and somebody would pass on the street, and she'd say, "That guy's crazy."
Not that she was judgmental.
No, not at all. And the great thing was that there would be great stories. I've told you one, which we've used on WAMC a million times. It's the story of Ethel Epstein's mother, who would come and see her and say, "Ethel, I haven't slept in 5 days." Put her head on the couch and go to sleep.
Right.
And we would say, "That's just like Ethel Epstein's mother." So she's quite famous here.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah. Yeah, well, she's famous in my house, too.
So a domineering mother, yes.
A domineering mother. And I started to... I wanted to explore, because my mother had a strong streak of anger in her, and I wanted to explore the relationship between anger and comedy, and that's how this play evolved.
Terrific.
And that's really what.
Without
what
giving
about.
It away, can you give us a little?
Well, you know, she seemed to always be ready for a fight. And
that's
some,
true.
You know, and sometimes that was a good thing, but sometimes it was not such a good thing. And as a kid growing up with it, you either sank or swam through it, you know, and fortunately I was able to stand up to her, as was my sister, which was, you know, a testament to the way we were raised, you know, but she was
Did she want to bring that out in you? In other words, you think that she, like Johnny Cash and the Born Names.
I think there were times where she felt that she could only make contact through argument. And I was not somebody who liked to do that. But so she engaged people through argument frequently. And, you know, she wanted me to be a lawyer, for instance. She didn't want me to be a writer. She wanted me to be a lawyer, which she was. My mother was a lawyer.
I knew that.
And
She didn't practice, though, right?
She practiced up until I was born. She practiced, or maybe up until my sister was born. She practiced for a while. But, you know, in those days, it was tough to be a woman lawyer because there were not the opportunities. They all had to do wills. You know, that was where they put women lawyers, in the wills department, you know. But she was enormously capable, and I think that probably was where much of her anger stemmed from, was that early kind of frustration of, with had all this ability and intelligence and talent and not a lot of outlets for it. So we had to deal with that. And I think that's where the anger probably originated.
So without giving it all away, is your heroine in this thing, or is your main character your mother?
Yeah, yeah. No, well, not my mother, but based on my mother, you know, certainly based on. Nobody in the play is identical, but you know, the character is based on my mother, and in fact, by the end of the play, she's a loving mother, you know. But it takes some getting there, you know, which is how a play should work, as far as I'm concerned. You got to get there, and it's the journey, you know. And there's quite a journey. It's not a long play, but a lot happens, and characters go through a lot, and it's funny. I hope. You know, we'll see when we get some people in the house.
Sure,
you know.
It is. David, one of the famous things that happened on Fire Island when we were growing up was that every year there was something called the teenage play. There was the Fire Island, the Fire Island play.
Right.
And, you know, everybody was in it. There were stars and there were not stars. Did that affect you at all?
No, not really. Only that I always went and I saw my friends. And I guess my best friend, who became one of my closest friends later, at the time he was older, was Tony Roberts.
Yeah.
And
tell us everybody, because people remember him from all the Woody Allen films and everything.
Right.
He's been everything. He's been everything, Law and Order. You name it, there he's been.
That's right.
But he was David to us, and then he became Tony. How come?
Simply because of an Equity actor who had the same name. So he had to. His name was is David Anthony Roberts. So, but there was another David Roberts in Equity. So he just went to Anthony Roberts, which became Tony Roberts.
Okay, I interrupted you. You were saying that you went to see him.
Yeah, and he was wonderful. I can remember him singing songs but I always tease him. You know, when he was dating my sister. So they were a couple years older than I was, right?
Because my brother dated his sister.
Oh, that's very funny. So he was dating my sister, and every time we talked, I had Tone come up to Colgate when I was up there to talk to the classes that I was teaching and watch one of his movies and talk to an audience about the movie. And I always, every chance I get, I introduce him as, you know, my friend who was dating my sister when I was in pajamas, and they'd go out on a date, and I'd come, you know, and eventually it got to the point where I said I'd stand at the top of the crib when they went out on their dates, you know.
That's funny.
But he was only a couple of years
old.
How
much older was Ellen than you, your
Ellen
sister?
Was 2 years older, and uh-huh. Tony was another year or so older.
Your play is being directed by James Norton,
right.
A very famous actor who's been in everything. He's one of those guys, you may not know the name coming up, but you certainly, once you see his face, you know who he is, yeah. And he's been in everything.
Yeah.
And now he's directing.
Right.
He's directed before, yes?
Yes, he's directed. I did Arthur Miller's The Price, and he did that on Broadway. He directed Our Town with Paul Newman on Broadway. And he directed a play of mine called Service to Air in New York, and he's directed quite a bit. And he's a wonderful director, and he's done, I think, a terrific job with this play. And we go way back, you know. We go back to Yale, and then
you're at Yale together.
Yeah, you know, his acting career is legendary at this point. He's won 2 Tonys, and he. Has a wonderful way with actors because, you know, that's where
How so?
He comes from. Well, you know, he understands actors because he is an actor, and that's a crucial thing for a director.
Yeah,
you
but
know?
For those of us who are, don't really understand this stuff, what's a wonderful way with an actor?
Well, you know, there's a way of telling people to do things, and there's a way of suggesting.
So you don't want to be authoritarian.
You want to suggest without being authoritarian.
Yes, exactly.
And that's the way he is. And, he has a genial personality, and people just love working with him. And this cast we have, which is I think a just terrific group of people, have really gotten to Jimmy. And there's this feeling in the room, you know, it doesn't always happen, you know, that the feeling in the room is a good one. I mean, because you're frequently, in fact, the last play we did together, we had a couple of tough people in the cast, and it made for some hard times. But that hasn't happened here because these people are really good. They're really professional and funny and delightful. You know?
So I've always been interested in the relationship between the playwright and the director.
Well, we have a relationship which has evolved, but... there are moments where it's uncanny, where I will take a note on something I'm watching as we're rehearsing, and as I'm about to pass, this has happened 2 or 3 times in this rehearsal period, as I'm about to pass the note to Jim, he'll say what I've written down to the actors. In other words, he's on the same beat at the same moment without having read my note.
But playwrights are sometimes seen by directors as a pain in the rear,
well,
and sometimes they really are collaborators.
Yeah, and if the playwright and the director don't get along, it can make for a rocky trip. None of which presages success. In other words, you can have a terrible relationship, and it can still work out to be a terrific production, or you can have a great relationship, and it can be a terrible production. You know, there's no way, but it certainly doesn't hurt to get along with the director, and we, you know, we do, and I think there's an atmosphere in the room that's very collaborative, and that's what the theater is about. It's about collaboration, and the writer, you know, if you don't want to collaborate, then you don't become a playwright. I mean, because you write novels, or you write something else, including screenplays, and I did that, but they don't want to really hear from the screenwriter on the movie set. You know, you're often not even invited.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the theater, the playwright is still, you know, central. And, you know, in a situation like the one we're in, you know, the actors are informing me about the play because they are doing it, you know, in front of my eyes, and I can see what needs to be changed.
So you change things on the scene.
Yeah. You know, things that don't work are clear. Things that need to be adjusted. I cut line, mostly cuts, but not a huge amount of cuts. But, you know, you work it out as it happens in front of you, and you can see what works. And you can't love your words too much because, you know, that's a real no-no. You know?
I get it.
That really...
What's Jill Eikenberry really like?
Oh, Jill's terrific. She...
Remind everybody about her background.
Right. Really. Jill and her husband, Mike Tucker, who's also in the play, Became very well known for L.A. Law, which is a big TV show, but they've done a number of television stuff and movies and theater. They're really...
We've been reading a spate of Marilyn Monroe's stories because of the anniversary of her death. And, you know, she's a pain in the rear on a set. What's Jill like?
Jill's terrific. She's very intense in her way, but also very... she doesn't want to do something that's dishonest, and that's why she'll hold back, and she'll hold back. And I'm thinking, as I'm watching her, what's going on here? And then suddenly something large will happen because she's found what she needs to find, the truth of the moment. And that you'll find many actors who aren't that way. You know, they'll just go for the emotional thing without the foundation. And Jill's always looking for the foundation of the moment before she expresses the emotion, which, you know, it's very smart, which she is.
But she's pretty. Is that a hindrance to the way in which you saw this thing developing?
None at all. No. In fact, you know, she looks right to me, you know, and she's doing it. She's wonderful.
Yeah. Show me an early picture of your mother and father in which your mom was quite gorgeous.
Yeah, she was.
And so maybe that's Jill now.
I'm very pleased to look at Jill and see what she brings to the part, which is...
Now, what happens after the play is the first night? I know Eric Hill, Kay McGuire's wonderful husband, told me that he's not allowed to make any changes after the thing begins because it's in the union contract. He did Chorus Line at of the Colonial Theater.
Right.
Are you allowed to go in afterwards and make tweets?
No one has told me that I can't, but it's not me. You know, I don't, you know, it would be Jimmy and, if I wanted to change a few lines, I would do it. I mean, no one can really tell a playwright you can't change your stuff. I don't know about a director. I don't know that as far as we're concerned that that's the case. But
it may not be. Same kind of production.
In any case, you know, we're... our stay here, official stay here, is over after the play opens. So, you know, they put us up until the day after opening, and then we're out of here. Yeah. We can come back on our own, but...
Well, you can always stay at our house.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah. I appreciate that.
David, is there a moment when you're looking at it? You know, I often say listening to myself on the radio is like, you know, sort of eating your own vomit. Very nice. So I'm wondering whether or not, you know, it can be. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can also be very happy with myself. Are there moments when you see your own stuff, you say, ooh?
I hope not in this play. You know, there are moments where if it's not working, where you kind of go, ooh, yeah. But I'm not finding them in this play. So that's
now, how about
nice.
The audience reaction?
Well, that's what we're going to find out. I mean, the audience teaches the playwright and the director and the actors, of course, an awful lot. And that's what we're waiting for, because particularly the comedy, you need an audience in the house to tell you where the laughs are going to come. Because we pretty much sure where some of the big ones would, but there might be laughs that we're not expecting at all. And conversely, there might be some we're hoping for that we don't get. So we're not going to know that until we hear an audience respond to the play. And that, you know, that's a crucial thing. And we're going to be in there with an audience. Our first preview is on the 14th. And that's going to be kind of nerve-wracking because it's all about timing. Because, you know, the actors aren't ready for a laugh. And if they don't give it a moment, you know, but you can't wait too long. It's intricate stuff.
Tell me about the goal. Is the goal to get to Broadway with this?
No. The goal here is to do this play as well as we possibly can. And one of the things I've learned is work on it as best you can and do what you can at the moment. And that's as far as I'm thinking. Jimmy and I did three, maybe four readings in New York and invited readings. In other words, we had actors who sat at a table. It was a seated reading and sat at a table and read the play to an audience. And that proved invaluable because after each reading, I did a big rewrite. You know, I changed things. And so the play evolved each time and got stronger and stronger, I think, so that by the time we got up here, I had a script that I felt very strongly about because I'd heard it three or four times in front of people. And that's quite valuable, you know.
at those readings, is that where casting occurs? To sometimes you with somebody you've invited that becomes a potential person
yeah.
to be in the
play? Yeah, in fact, two or three out of the people in our cast were in our readings. One is Mike Tucker, who's Jill's husband, who's played the father from the very first reading, and Jimmy and I loved him and said, boy, we'll get him again for the reading. And the other is Jackie Hoffman, who is one of New York's funniest actors and a terrific actor and comedian. And Jackie has been with us all along. And she's just fabulous. So we have then the two of them were in every reading we did, I think. And Jackie might have missed one, but they were crucial, and then they came with us. And then the rest of the cast is three younger people whom we love, Clea Alsip and David Ross and Tara Franklin. And they are, you're going to love them. I think they're terrific.
I'm sure I'm going to love them, and I can't wait to see it. Sounds like a great play, and of course the Fire Island connection makes me even get there a little faster. Our guest has been playwright David Epstein, whose play Brace Yourself will receive its world premiere at the Berkshire Theatre Group's Fitzpatrick Main Stage beginning August 18th. David, I can't imagine that an hour can go faster for me than this one did, and I thank you so much for doing it with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alan Chartok. You're listening to WAMC.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org. We'll be right back.